everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. It's just me and Dave with a rapid fire show, but I have a couple sponsors to mention at the top of the show first. One, of course, Environments for Humans, our longtime conference sponsors. This is going to air just a few days before me and Dave are off in Orlando, Florida for In Control Conference. But In Control does a lot more conferences, too, and we'll tell you about some of those later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off.
Welcome to Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hi, everybody. My voice sounds a little rough. It's okay. Don't worry about me.
It's all right.
Yeah, I feel fine. It's just a remnant of flu-ness.
We'll get you better, buddy. Nurture you back to health. Because today we have a rapid fire episode.
I like that we do these, and we get good feedback on these too. People like the rapid fire, so I like that we switch it up and do this. This is where me and Dave don't have a guest. It's just me and Dave, and we talk about where we just can try to get through as many questions as we can. And I put together a big old pile of them this week.
Yeah, let's just get to it. Question number one comes from Eric Torres of New York City, man. I've been in the IT support field for over 10 years. About 2 years ago, it struck me like a unicorn horn through the heart. Oh, that's beautiful. A unicorn horn through the heart when I realized my soul was in design and development. I've been trying to level up and, like the last dragon, finally achieve the glow. Awesome movie reference, Eric. Applying for jobs is hard when you have no industry experience and can't afford a pay cut. Time is limited when you are doing something you hate more than IE7. Could use some general ideas on career change.
It sounds like you have the motivation to do it. Just like the logistics of it are pretty hard.
Mm-hmm. And I would say it sounds like you have the skills as well. Just moving, laterally is tough because you don't have, 10 years of design and development skills.
Right.
That's tough. And I would bet it's tough in New York City, seems like a competitive high,
That's true. You know what, though? You know what? So you have 10 years of IT support experience. So it may be hard for you to turn your back on that entirely and forever. This just hit me, but you know who likes to hire people that are like very like bards, they can do a lot of different things. The startups, they try not to hire people that are too siloed and to be like, I just work in PSDs and that's it. They need people that can do lots of different stuff. And now here you are with some pretty good skill and lots of different things. You can do some of this IT support stuff. Maybe you can run a server. Maybe you have some pretty interesting specialized other abilities in IT, but now you can design and develop and do front end stuff, which is also a very sought after thing. So maybe you could work somewhere that's startup-ier that was like just funded. Look for somewhere that just got a bunch of money.
They overpay people. Yeah. I think that's probably the best bet. There's a lot of really great startups in New York City and Brooklyn and Williamsburg and all that. So that might be an option for you. I think you'd have to go out and schmooze and meet people, but I know they're always hiring. So
especially for front end, if that's what you're jumping into, I feel like that's always one of the things that's hard to hire. It doesn't always seem like it to every front ender out there. But in my experience in Silicon Valley and stuff, man, front end is a sought after position.
And there may be a cut if you're like a junior front end developer, but I bet people are looking for people. A friend of the show, Brad Frost, just quit his job at RGA and their fancy pants agency and maybe take his job. No, that's There's
exactly. If you're trying to avoid that pay cut, you might run into some issues there. If you absolutely can't take any pay cut, just because you will be junior, I guess, right away. But maybe you can parlay that other experience you have. Go half and half for a little while.
Yeah, if you're like front end and ops, that's a pretty killer combo. I mean, if you know how to like set up an Nginx server like in your sleep, that's pretty good. So maybe that's something. I don't know what kind of IT you do. That's probably the big.
Too bad you're not from like the Midwest or something. And I'm from the Midwest, so I'm not crapping on that. But like, if that was the case, you could move to a larger metro, you know, larger area, and then the pay would be higher, just commensurate. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But you're already in New York, so
everything's a step down.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. I think that's it. I mean, it's going to be tough on the junior level, but I feel like you could do it if you just look for startups and agencies, and you know,
focus on the unicorn.
Yeah,
I'm the dragon.
Eyes on the prize. So, all right, cool. Next question is an audio question from a longtime listener of the show, John Stevie. Here we go.
Hi, Chris and Dave. I just got done listening to the episode about, well, I guess both episodes were about this, but about IDs and classes and CSS. And I have to kind of agree with you, Chris, that, you know, most of the time, IDs aren't needed. A lot of times, they get in your way. But what I've kind of found is kind of a good in between is to use them as if I was building a module for something. So, and what I mean by that is
IDs as modules.
Never use IDs on something that's such a parent element, like the main wrapper, but rather to use it on a small thing. So, for example, Dave mentioned a pagination, you know, element, which had a class of pagination or something. So instead of using, you know, a class on that, you could give that an ID of pagination, and then inside of that use classes. And then what that allows you to do is I can call the ID of pagination. Now, when it comes to a bigger project, I see exactly what you're talking about as far as having other people involved with it, and it gets complicated because then someone writes something else that overwrites that, da, da, da. But if you don't use it as a parent selector and you only use it as a module, then the only times that you end up having an issue with that in a team situation is when someone is simply, I guess, using that style somewhere else, not knowing that you created that module. But just like whenever you work in, you know, a server side something with modules, server side code with modules in a team, people need to know what modules exist. And people need to know what's out there in the rest of the application. So just like it is with the server side, I think with CSS, if you're working in a team, you need to have some type of way to communicate to everyone. Maybe whether that's like a, you know, list in Basecamp or whatever, however you're working. So maybe something within the file that you update that kind of lists out, hey, here's like our things that we need to communicate back and forth to each other. Here's our like ID modules, things like that, so that there isn't any kind of people stepping on each other's toes.
I think we get the
CSS and that sort of thing. Anyways,
so it's like there's two big parts to that. One is like where you use classes and IDs, and then John's second part was, you know, kind of communicating like a table of contents of what's mm-hmm. available to
people. Yeah. So like maybe you have a developer document or something that's like, these are the IDs of the modules we're using, et cetera, right?
Sure. And that's fine. I mean, yes, if you can do that and you promise to keep it up to date and it's not going to be this kind of useless waste of time that nobody's going to look at, you know, if somebody's asking you for it and you can provide it, great. I would worry that you'd spend 3 days doing it and then it'll go out of date and nobody will ever look at it. And it's not that useful. You mm-hmm. know, there's certainly, I think Dave, you've even played around with some JavaScript that kind of would automatically create these type of things. Isn't it like
my data, what is it? Data code block sort of thing.
Yeah, right. Like it either took some CSS and showed you the HTML that was used on it, or the other way around.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, automating that type of thing is a better plan, I feel like, than trying to keep some document up to date.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I understand what John's saying, and I definitely did this for the longest time. And I, you know, it was like, ID, like pound site header. And then all my site header styles went under and were prefixed with the site header, ID. Right. But I guess, you know, so here's two things. There's specificity, right? So like anytime you're trying to override a style, you have to use that pound site header, right? Or he used the example of pagination. We can, either one works here. So if I say pound site header A, you know, color pink, and I want to change all the links pink, that's, you know, I have to use the ID selector, you know, and no class will override that. And it's easy in JavaScript to add classes and just riff and, you know, like I'm going to append 900 classes to this thing just because, you know. So that's where the win came for me in using classes and even further generalizing, you know, I mean, quite seriously, like the word class and object are somewhat interchangeable in programming, you know? So it's just interesting. Like classes are way more suited for kind of creating objects, I feel. And then the second thing I had, I was working on a project, and they straight up told me, like, hey, we can't use IDs because IDs can be basically randomly generated. So, like, they're going to, like, A-B testing, and they need the ID for the A-B test. So it's like, you know, ID div XBNPR5-824. And
so there was this arbitrary event happened that said you can never use IDs because we're always
good. Yeah, they're basically randomized, you know.
I would kind of love that.
I mean, it's kind of extreme, but I, you know, it was just sort of like, this is, you know, this is the framework and this is how we have.
But what happened? You use all classes and
how? Well, so I started out in IDs and then, yeah, I had to rip out and go to all classes. And dude, I mean, I just realized I was able to just thrash code. I mean, like, you know, I mean, you just, first it's like find replace, you know, and it's like, you know, replace pound site header with dot site header, you know? So it's not like a huge effort to like replace that and add a class, but then, you know, you're looking at your nested modules, right? Like, you know, if you have, you can start breaking out these classes into smaller modules and when you're not faced with like prefixing, you know, maybe you want the second level of links, like a drop down menu, to look different than the top level links, you know? So if you did site header or ID site header A, you guys tracking me? ID site header A, then you'd have to do ID site header A plus A or whatever, like just to get like the any links after that A, you know? So I feel like classes sort of win the day.
Yeah, they have an infinitely less specificity than an ID does, and that becomes a big deal when you never have to worry about an ID kind of raining on the parade. Like everything has this baseline of it's a class, mm-hmm. or less. It's really nice. Mm-hmm. I should say, I mean, early in John's comment, and I'm sure you know what all this stuff is so. If it works for you, just kind of go for it. I'm not like trying to jam this down anybody's throat, but I honestly would do it exactly the opposite of what John was describing. He said, don't use your ID on something like a body or a page wrap or something, but do use it on something like pagination. And to me, that was like, oh, and I would do the opposite of that. I would be like, well, you're guaranteed there's only one body on the page. So that, you know, if there's any place where you could, I don't know, you need some kind of hardcore override, maybe that would be the place to add an ID.
Mm-hmm.
Body anyway, even though you can still use the class and it will still cascade. Anyway, But pagination, and this has literally happened to me several times I can think of in the past year or two, where there was pagination at the bottom of the page, and it really just became obvious that that pagination should be repeated at the top of the page because there's a lot of scrolling involved. And now you have a case where you've depended on a hashed, you know, an ID on that pagination element, and now you're duplicating it. Now that the styling will still work, but that's weird. Have two elements on this page with the same ID. It's really bad mojo. So,
yeah,
something that's like that, a repeatable design pattern component should absolutely be a class, not an ID.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, there, you know, like you were saying, it's whatever works for you. You know, there are things like evergreen sort of areas of your site. Like you're probably not going to have two site footers, you know? And that's if you're true. Controlling the design and everything, you're probably not going to, right? But
it comes down to that specificity.
Yeah, I mean, maybe on the about page, you want the site footer to be a little different or something, you know, or I don't know. But
yeah, you're like, oh, you know what? You know what, guys? I only have one footer on my site, so I'm going to say hashtag footer down there, and I'm going to style stuff in the footer with the hash instead of a class name. Oh, but now I want to take this, but I'm going to be really smart about the module pattern everywhere else on this entire site. But now I have this module I want to put down in the footer. And now that strong specificity of things I've styled inside my footer are competing with the module where that module didn't have to deal with that or where it was placed anywhere else on the site. So just because it appears once on the site isn't an excuse to why it shouldn't have a class.
Yeah.
Just treat everybody as kind of equal citizens on your site. And it just will feel good, I promise. If you do a site and you just draw a line in the sand and you say, I'm only going to use classes to style things, it will feel good.
Using IDs is a one-way ticket to important town. Is that good? All right. Well, cool. I feel like we got that one. Thanks, John, for calling in. We appreciate it. Next question comes from Tyler. Here we go.
Hey, Chris and Dave. Can you recommend some resources for learning more about HTAccess? I've been starting to use a lot of code from the HTML5 boilerplate, but I'd like to understand more, especially on the proper way to set up redirects and rewrites and make them myself, rather than just relying on modifying and testing snippets that I find. Thanks.
HTAccess. Yeah. I'll come out and
voodoo.
Yeah, it's voodoo. I'll come out and say I have like a mild love affair with the HTML5 boilerplate HTAccess file, like their default one. Dude, so many gems in there. If you just like go read through it, I've like fantasized about doing a screencast about it. So.
Yeah, I have on my list of like stuff that should be in your HTAccess file blog post, but I'm like, I don't know, it's all in here, so just read that.
I mean, other than like WordPress like stuff, you know, which you would only need if you're using WordPress, it's
and there's so little of that. It's just that one little chunk, unless you use the W3 total cache, which has a bunch of stuff in there, but it kind of self manages that stuff. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, he's. I think he wants to get beyond just the, you know, automated stuff. So, I mean, maybe he's, you know, he wants to get into like custom URL, pretty URLs and stuff like that. Do you know of any resources on that, Chris? Or
I do. I put this in here for one reason, because I wanted to promote my my old buddy Jeff Starr, who co-authored with me the Digging into WordPress book. He has a new book out called HTAccess Made Easy. The URL for that is htaccessbook.com. It's literally an entire book about HTAccess. So if you're like interested in it, and Jeff is a good writer and he's very comprehensive and straightforward and clear about this. So I would check that out as a resource. And then you can come on the show and teach us how to use HTAccess, because I still kind of, I usually find somebody smart on Twitter to help me when I'm having an HTAccess problem.
You know, I used to know my stuff, right? Like I could code a rewrite, but dude, if you don't.
Well, I can code a rewrite. Well, 301.
Dude, I'm not good at it anymore. I forget. Like, and every time I like Google some tutorial and try to figure out how, it's just like, wonk, wonk.
Well, if it's one page to another page, I can do it. But what comes on. The problem is all of a sudden you're like, but I want to redirect anything. This is a real one that exists on CSS Tricks as we speak. that any slug that starts with, if it's css.com/ and then an integer dash, and then something, I want it to redirect to the entire URL that it finds, but remove that integer at the beginning. Because there was an old school format on CSS Tricks that where I had to temporarily use an integer there. And the URLs are all exactly the same, only the integer is gone. So now you're in like regex territory.
Yeah.
But like, what kind of regex? Is it like JavaScript regex? Or isn't there different types of regex? Is this weird voodoo regex? Or and then there's like weird like dollar signy stuff that replaces things. And like, it's weird.
Yeah.
And you got to learn it.
Yeah. No. Yeah. That's, I mean, that's where like that book sounds like it'd come in handy. So, you know, I thought I had my stuff together and, now my server has Nginx sitting in front of it. So like, that's a whole other set of configs. And that's more like, just like almost like a string of JSON that you configure, but I don't know how to code it. So, or like, I don't know what flags I need to set.
The HTML5 boilerplate has an Nginx configuration.
Well, I maybe need to drop it in. So, but yeah, so like gzip on my site isn't turned on right now. So I need to,
that's definitely in there.
I know. I need to just go through and do it.
I was doing an audit just last night on CodePen of looking at every single asset that we load and seeing and just checking the headers on everything and making sure that they're gzipped and they have far expires headers and we're using the right URLs for everything and all that type of stuff. So, yep, you're right. That's where all this stuff comes into play.
Yeah, I mean. And like you should, I think it should be in everyone's radar, you know, like everyone, any front ender's radar, like, cause it is very important to performance and stuff like that. But, you know, don't be afraid to get a professional involved. That's for true. So, all right. That's kind of where I stand. Yeah, you think cool. We covered it then? Yeah. All right. Next question is. Yeah, another audio question. Guys, you are doing amazing here. This is awesome. Here we go.
Hey there, I'm Jolt, and I love your show. Thanks for your latest answer, and I got another one. I keep hearing about Austin, Texas, in your show or the ATX web show, and I'm from Europe, and I was wondering what is so special about this city in Texas, like web development-wise. Why is the industry so vivid there and stuff like this? Thanks for your answer.
That is like my favorite question in the whole wide world. What is the big deal about Austin, Texas? It's my dream that someone would ask that. Well, Zolt, I live in Austin, Texas. So do you need any more? I don't know. Austin is, so, I mean, you probably heard of South, so you're in Europe, and so you probably heard of South by Southwest. It's like an annual conference every year, happens right here in Austin, Texas. Like Twitter launched here, like tons of, you know, I mean, it just, that happened at South by and gained momentum and stuff like that. So Austin kind of has a big name from all of that. But besides that, like there's a lot of, web development stuff going on in Austin, and I'm a little biased, obviously, but because I do the ATX web show as well. But it's, you know, it's a really awesome environment. There's, you know, there's meetups every night. And they have hundreds of people and they're all developers and not recruiters and stuff like that. Like it's like actual, like, you know, people like looking to learn, and there's like meetups every single night. It's amazing. So, I don't know, man. I just never met or seen a community quite as vibrant as this. And I've lived in other towns across, you know, the states, and there are some really good towns, like Phoenix has a good scene. Greenville has a good scene, here in the United States. Brooklyn's a pretty good scene. I mean, there's probably lots of stuff in San Francisco and Palo, but there's so many companies there, it's pretty diluted, maybe. I don't know. Chris, any thoughts?
Did you mention the barbecue?
Oh, there's also barbecue, the best barbecue in the whole wide world. There's the best beer in the whole wide world. There's the best, geez, this is going to take a while. There's this stuff called...
That's a good music scene.
The It's the live Beyond music capital
country,
of the world.
Western. It's all kinds of that stuff going
any
on.
Any kind of music.
Nice people. It has just the right touch of Southern flair, I feel like.
Southern hospitality. When you go into a restaurant, people are probably going to be nice to you, which is not common around the whole United States. Yeah, dude, it's a good town. I mean, just think about it.
Speaking of Austin, we have, you know, Environments for Human sponsors this show. They do all kinds of conferences. Me and Dave will very shortly be at In Control Orlando. That's just in a few days from now. So technically you could still show up if you want to, and we'd love to see you there. But chances are you've already made your decision on that one. So here's one a little further out where you may be still in position to make a decision about. And that's the Artifact Conference at the URL artifactconf.com. Oh, that's May 13th through 15th in Austin, Texas. So you had another reason to go to Austin. Another conference that's outside of the South by Southwest zone. It's a bit after, a few months after that. So it will be kind of regular Austin, as it were. I feel like it's such a big event that it really kind of changes Austin for that time. I'm sure. I don't think I've ever been to Austin outside of that, but it really does seem.
Yeah. During South by Southwest, it's like this is like San Francisco's spring break, kind of sort of like party, but it's a lot more relaxed on a general day to day. There's still some traffic, but it's pretty relaxed. So,
but you will get to experience at Artifact Conf if you go there. So check that out. The tickets go on sale February 5th. So I think by the time this airs, you'll be able to buy a ticket for it, which is fantastic. So we'll tell you more about that as it comes out.
Yeah.
This is kind of a brand new thing. There's also one for your calendar. Remember when we were in Hawaii?
Yes, I do.
One of the reasons was CSS DevConf, and that's coming back as well. And that's coming back October 21st through 23rd in 2013. So, I mean, it's January now. This is a long time away, but they've announced the dates for it. So if you're a super planner, mark down October 21st through 23rd. That's going to be in Denver.
Yeah, so, dude. Denver in the summer. Now we're talking. It's really cool. I would say the CSS DevConf was super fun in Hawaii. The like ability to just nerd out about like really random CSS stuff is super cool.
I love conferences that are super specific.
Dude, I was like getting nosebleeds, like talking about like, you know, like whatever, like using a checkbox, like a label select positioned off screen to like change your whole site. Ah, it's awesome. Anyway, so think about that. Hey, when we're in Orlando for In Control, we should rent one of those swamp buggies. With the big fans.
So obnoxious, dude. I used to go camping all the time in Florida. Little known fact, Florida is awesome for camping because not a lot of people camp in Florida. So you end up getting usually, I don't know, we found this place where we could, all over this organization that would rent us campsites. And we'd have like a football field to ourselves. It was amazing. And anyway, I always remember if you get too close to a swampy area, there's always somebody that has one of those jackass things. And you're like, I'm trying to make a marshmallow and it's so loud.
I want to be that guy. All right, cool. Let's move on to Alex Policastro. I like the last name. It's like police and Castro slammed together.
Yeah, but somehow that makes it more relaxed.
Yeah, I like it. So I'm really interested in SAS, but I don't work with Ruby and mainly work with WordPress. Is it even possible to use SAS with WordPress? And if it is, would it even be worth it? Sorry if this question has been asked before. No worries. Also, if you have any tips for workflow in developing and designing WordPress sites, I'd like to hear them. Chris?
I want to know how you would answer this.
I understand what he's saying. So SAS does, it works with WordPress, like, and now there's GUIs and all this stuff like CodeKit or Compass app, or, there's tons of user interfaces, which will let you compile your SAS into CSS.
Locally on your computer that's sitting in front of you, right?
On your computer that's sitting in front of you right now.
That's where this question gets hairy. And I had one that was less just the other day. Somebody's like, oh, I've been working in less. And I worked on my site locally and then I pushed it up to the server. And then he's like, now what do I do? Now when I want to make a CSS change, I'll make that CSS change. And he uses something like Coda. So he's directly FTP'd into that site, makes a change to the less file. Now what? Now what's there's nothing watching that file anymore and compiling it into CSS. What do you do? What's that process like? And I can see how that's confusing. And that's why this world of pre-processing, I always like to bundle it when I talk about it with the idea of working locally in the workflow of version control and you know, working on your site locally and pushing it up through some kind of deployment system to your live site. So you're never logged into Coda directly through FTP and making changes there. Because you run into problems like these. What do you do? And now, if you're working with WordPress on that server, that means PHP is on that server because WordPress only works with PHP. Mm-hmm. You probably don't have Ruby even running on it. It's probably not even an option. Now, there's been some murmurs and talks about some ways to compile Sass and JavaScript and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not a super great idea.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say you got to get off of this direct FTP workflow and get all local all the time and then add some kind of deployment step to your workflow so that you are, you know, you're working locally, you're using some kind of tool, and there's so many of these tools now to compile your Sass locally. For one, you can just use the command line and work on it that way. There's compass.app. There's CodeKit, which is my favorite one that works great. There's Live Reload. There's Mixture.io. There's so many of these tools to watch your project and compile Sass automatically. And you put the SCSS files right in your WordPress theme in your style.css file, the root of your WordPress file. And you know, there's some tricks here. A lot of times the CSS file that I put at my root of my WordPress theme will just be nothing. It will just be either blank, or it'll have just the comments at the top of the style.css file that say the name of the theme and, you know, the tags and the version and all that stuff. You know what I'm talking mm-hmm. about? Like the mm-hmm. but otherwise it'll be empty. But then in my header.php file in WordPress, I'll link up a global.css file from a buried folder, from a folder like /css.
Okay.
That way I can have two folders in my WordPress theme, SCSS and CSS. That way I can use Compass and I can say, hey, Compass, watch those two folders. And that way I'm not muddying up the root of the theme, because chances are there's not just going to be one CSS file. There's going to be reset and typography, and maybe I'll have a session just for comments. I like to break out my CSS into little chunks. And if I did that right in the root, that would be annoying. Mm-hmm. Right? You would just, the root of your theme file would just be littered with all these little files. So I like to just bury them into an SCSS folder and a CSS folder. That's kind of the standard the Compass wants you to use anyways.
Mm-hmm.
And then your head.php file, just link up that global. And you're all set there. So yeah, WordPress doesn't care. But you can't be on this FTP workflow. You got to get off of that stuff. So I have screencasts on that stuff. Check out the one on CSS Tricks that's like, I don't know, get yourself deploying in 5 minutes or something like that. I can't remember what it is. But in that particular one, it uses Beanstalk for deployment. But I'd like to start doing more of those because that's not the only option.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I like Beanstalk, there's some open source projects that work great. And, you know, get your project on GitHub and then have some kind of project move your stuff from GitHub to your live server, and you'll love it. You'll love it.
Yeah, I think, you know, Chris, you have a talk right now about like the modern web workflow, which is and you posted your slides recently. I would go check those out, Alex. I think sums up what, you know, you're saying. It's just like we have to like all grow up just a little bit in how we're testing locally and deploying publicly, you know. So if you're just, you know, what was it called, like in Giant Mnemonic, was it called like jacking in or something? Terrible. But it was like basically just jumping into the FTP and you're like editing stuff and like the screen goes white and all that all the time. Like, let's all stop doing that. So that's kind of yeah, where this is.
And it's really not that big of a deal, guys. You know, like the 2 second version of it is, if you want to use a tool like Beanstalk, which is this web hosted service, you just give them your FTP information and you host your Git repository with them.
Mm-hmm.
And you're basically done. You say like, okay, well, when I commit, I want you to deploy to it. And it can get more fancy than that, but it's not this setup that takes a hardcore nerd to figure it out.
Yeah.
I know I'm resistant to stuff like this. I'm not good at stuff like this, but using a tool like Beanstalk really kind of walks you through it.
Yeah.
Okay. Enough of that. But WordPress doesn't care. Yes, you can use SAS and WordPress together. I do it every day.
Awesome. Next question is an audio question, our favorite kind of question, from Adam Freiberg. Adam from Chicago, he calls himself.
Hey, Chris and Dave, this is Adam from Chicago. First off, I love the show. I normally tune in after it's live, and usually it's when I'm working out. You guys and your crazy sound effects and your awesome guests, you're my background track, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate it when you have hot drama. I mean, the hot drama just makes the workout that much better. So thank you. My question's about style guides. I work on a team of developers, most of whom are not design-oriented. They want to see examples of the styles possible, and they want to see which classes to use that are already defined in our Bootstrap-based framework. So is there a technique or a tool you use to create style guides and keep them updated as your CSS matures? I've seen Nile style sheets. I guess the K is silent. It's also called KSS, but I wasn't really good enough with Ruby to get that working. I've seen StyleDoco, which is node-based. I'm looking for guidance, sirs. Thanks for your awesome show.
Style guides and style tiles.
Well, we just briefly talked about this in the beginning question of kind of like, if there's any way you can automate this kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
I mean, one thing I do is, you know, I'll take, there's a couple, all the like guys in the UK do really, really good style guides. But basically you just need an up-to-date version of the component, like your menu navigation, your carousel, your accordion, you know, all these little things.
Your tabs, your buttons.
Yeah, your tabs, your button. Think Bootstrap. Like when you go to Bootstrap, like the whole website is basically a style guide, like after the first page. So,
right. So that's an option right there, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm just take that because that comes as part of the open source thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's
alter it and that's your style.
It's guide. A docs folder, quite literally. So you could just use that if your hooks are all the same, or maybe you need to go through and prune that up and clean that up, just to add what they look like.
The two other options you mentioned are good too. They kind of automate the creation of a style guide.
Mm-hmm.
And I know one of them was complicated and whatever. Another one is just to handcraft it. That's what we did while I was at SurveyMonkey. I was kind of like head up the style guide thing project there, which I believe is still in use, which was pretty cool. It was kind of like just a bunch of sections. So like Dave said, it's buttons and tabs and carousels and accordions and all that stuff. And we would have a big section and it would have a demonstration of all the different possible versions that you could use. There'd be a little code sample on how to use it. There would be a little bit of writing that would explain relevant bits. Like if you want the accordion to, have one panel open only, and if you open another panel, we'll close the other one that was open. Or do you want it so that multiple panels can be open? Well, it's just put this different data attribute on it or whatever. You have to explain that with some words. So that type of stuff is there. Handcraft it. You may want to just look at the route of handcrafting it, because it sounds like you work with some smart developers who are literally asking you for this.
Mm-hmm.
A lot. That's a good place to be in.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times these things are a result of some kind of, you know, I'm tapping the tips of my fingers together, design mastermind who decides that this is a good idea for his organization and spends 2 months on a style guide and then has this big presentation and nobody cares.
Yeah.
And they don't really intend to look at it when they, you know, when they craft pages and whatever. And it turns out to be this. It seemed like a good idea at the time, but, you know, nobody's like in charge of dealing with this.
Yeah.
I've seen that happen too. And I've seen a lot of people kind of crap talk style guides for that reason. And that they always seem like a good idea in some designer's mind. And then real life, they don't. But you're getting asked for this, so.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, kind of what you were saying, Chris, like you can spend months developing these PSDs that, you know, this InDesign document that's perfect and describes everything. But like, dude, it's nothing like in a world of like HTML, you know, like I feel like HTML counts, you know, so you're going to have to figure out how to get these into HTML and you know, how that's going to look and work in HTML. So especially with responsive and all that, I feel like it's a must. So yeah, I don't know.
Absolutely. And you know, are you going to use it or not? Like, that's a big deal too, is that I feel like the people that build and maintain the style guide should be the people that are the customer of it.
And, you know, and it can also cover you. It can work as like a, you know, we talked about this in the Divya and Garen episode, like a functional test. It can work like a functional test or, you know, cause it's like, if you change CSS and it broke your style guide, like, you know, now your headlines are skewed or something like that. I mean, that, you know, that's a problem. So, you know, it can work like a test case for good or bad ideas. So if you have it, so that's my deal. Cool. I'm going to move along. Thanks, Adam. You're a buff guy. Yeah. You'll figure it out. You work out. Kevin wrote in, what is the best way of learning how to design websites in the likes of Photoshop while keeping in mind that the layout will later have to be coded into semantic HTML and CSS? I consider myself to be a decent coder, but easily get lost when trying to create mockups due to not knowing the exact limitations of HTML and CSS. Ah, it seems as if I have great ideas in the likes of Photoshop, but cannot translate these ideas to a functioning site. I have quick question about using media queries in SAS. This is kind of separate. Should I group my media queries according to the breakpoint so that I have all the properties and selectors that apply for that breakpoint together?
This is like a second question.
Yeah.
Totally different.
Do you want to just tackle the first one, Aaron?
Let's do that first just so that we don't lose our minds.
I'll go ahead and say the answer to the second one is it doesn't matter. So just rock on, whatever is the best for you. So the first question, he wants to design websites well in Photoshop,
That's funny. Normally this question is from the other side. It's like, I want to get better at code, but I already know Photoshop. And he's like, I'm a decent coder, but I want to learn how to design in Photoshop, I'm not laughing. It's just, it's interesting that it's the other way. And he's worried that, I don't know, like, that he should, I don't know, not dumb down, but like make photos, like be aware of all the things that you can't do in HTML, CSS so that you don't do them in Photoshop.
Yeah,
the vibe.
Yeah, like what are the faux pas, Photoshop faux pas, classic traps? My biggest one would be thinking the canvas is the limitation. Over my last whatever X number of years, I've seen a lot of designers like be like, you know, it's cool, full background images. So I'm going to put that like over here and it's going to be like a full background image. And then my text is just going to lay on top of it. And it's like doing that is kind of a pain in the butt. Cause like, how are you going to scale that background image or like, where does it crop off? You know, are you going to force the browser to be like a certain width? You know, I feel like, that's a classic trope, you know, is these, I'm just going to use this whole canvas and it'll be perfect, you know, because I opened my Photoshop document at 1024 by 768 and it's perfect. Knowing how your site is going to bleed, that's a classic like print design term. When you know your site maxes out at a width, and but the browser keeps going or something like that, you know how your site is going to bleed is a big, you know, skill too. So don't think that the canvas you're looking at is a web page. think of it.
That's a good one.
You know,
oh, that's a good tip. I mean, it seems obvious, but you know, think about that, or you know, maybe pick a couple of different canvas sizes and design them simultaneously. Not I know that's one of the reasons that people make fun of Photoshop and why we're in a post PSD era.
Old Brad Frost there.
Yeah, is that that's a little impractical, and making full fidelity mockups of every possible screen size is ridiculous. But that doesn't say that that's how you have to use Photoshop. It can still just be for visual exploration bits. And I would say, don't think of the limitations of CSS and HTML while you're in Photoshop. Just for fun, forget all that. Just try to do something crazy. You know, try to design the right solution that looks beautiful, works great, thinks of the user, all that type of stuff. And then when you go to code it, you know, it bums me out that somebody would be like, think of some limitation of HTML and CSS and then not do something creative in Photoshop because of their perceived limitation. Because your idea of perceived limitation is going to be a little different. You know, I just feel like do something crazy in it and then figure it out in code. I mean, code is incredibly powerful. I mean, there's going to be some creative way to figure it out. And if not, then adjust it slightly so that it's doable. But don't like limit your creativity before it's time to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's classic, like, design versus engineering. You know, I mean, like architects, for example, they, you know, who is it? Frank Gehry. He just like scribbles on a piece of paper and he's like, here's your building, you know, $10 million or whatever, right? Scribbles on a napkin. And like, you know, then it's up to the engineers to figure out like, how can we do that? You know? And it's like, well, you made a, you know, there's a window that's just floating in outer space here. So we can't do that by the laws of physics. So maybe it has a hanger on it that holds the window, you know, just some, you know, that's a weird example, but you know,
I follow you
in code, you're making the concessions, you know, and this happens in any kind of engineering, you know, like I wanted to make this really cool bridge go across, you know, the Mississippi River, but turns out like the Mississippi River has the wrong kind of dirt and I can't use this kind of concrete, you know, or whatever. Like there's weird stuff. Like, I mean, not, that's not just limited to code, you know? So,
But maybe there's some solution and we'll figure it out. It'd be kind of like, you just don't want to make those decisions too early. Like, I'm going to design a house and it's going to be brick. And then you're like, and then the architect's like, oh, it's going to be brick. Okay. Well, it has to be a square then.
Yeah.
Because this architect didn't like, just is limiting his own creativity based on perceived abilities of brick.
Yeah.
That may not even be correct.
Yeah. I think you can break out of, I think go wild in Photoshop, and that's, you know, figuring it out in semantic HTML. That's the fun part. That's like, that's what we did at Parallel for the longest time. I mean, we still do that. I mean, we're just like, I don't know. I'm just going to make a web page about Alan Rickman. Cool. Let's figure it out. You know? So there you go. Do that. I feel like you got it.
Right.
All right.
You got to read it. My voice sucks.
Thomas McKay wrote in, says, I use Firebug and Firefox to stay live, to style live in the browser. What other tools do you use for designing in browser? Is there a tool like Firebug where I can actually change the HTML in the browser, not just the CSS?
Oh, interesting. Does Firebug allow you to, like, if you make those changes, does it save it back out to file?
Yeah, you can do a save to file thing.
From Firebug?
Yeah, yeah. I saw it a long, long time ago. I haven't used it in a decade. Quite seriously.
I know Remy Sharp just did a video about doing this with JavaScript because Chrome DevTools can also save to file. Mm-hmm. So you make a change and it runs in the browser, which is super cool. And then you pick what file it should save to. And then anytime you make another change and save it again, it won't bug you again. It'll just know that you've paired this up with this file, and it will save. So you can literally edit JavaScript right in Chrome DevTools, which is cool. I don't know if you can do CSS or HTML, but I do know that they want to and are planning to.
Yeah. I want to say it's... Ooh. I'm trying to hack it right now. Oh, heck yeah. You can in the Chrome beta.
Nice.
Let's see.
Save which one? HTML?
Yeah, you can save...
But you don't really get like a true code edit. You like the editing is weird, right? Like you click on an attribute and then you can edit just that attribute, or you can click on a value and change that value. But you don't ever get like a, well, maybe I'm wrong. Do you ever get like just a true editor?
You know, in the sources tab of the web inspector, I think that's where all this is happening. So I'm trying to, I'm trying to hack it right now. I'm doing like star background pink important. Oh, I can't get it to work, but
you totally can.
Like, so it's happening. It's happening.
How do you save though?
I think you just hit like Command S or whatever your save tool is, you know. Anyway, you might have to like right click and do local modifications or whatever, and then you're going. So yeah, it's interesting. There's some dev tools videos out there. I think it's Paul Irish probably doing it. But yeah, look out for those. Those are pretty good. It's kind of the future there. So being able to basically develop entirely in browser, which is wild. So, or, you know, patch up or fix or whatever. So.
Yeah, and so this is a thing like, well, you can't really write SAS in it, so that's kind of out.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe someday you will be able to.
Yeah, like once we get, you know.
I mean, source maps are already kind of working.
Yeah.
In Chrome DevTools, so maybe that would work, actually.
Kind of getting cool. Yeah. I don't know. That's pretty cool, though. Hopefully that helps you out. I think it's pretty cool. You want to do one more, Chris, or?
Well, let's do one more and then be done.
Yeah, that sounds good. Colin Ledger writes in, says, I've fallen in a rut of reading too many sites and not building enough. My 15-plus year career is at a standstill in the web industry. That means every day that goes by, I'm actually falling behind. FYI, I'm working for the government with SharePoint. Dun, dun. What do you suggest I do from here? I wouldn't mind freelancing, but I've lost complete confidence since everyone with an internet connection can apparently build websites. That's funny. With freelancing, design and development are not a problem. What about content? How do you deal with it? Do you ask for the client to provide the content, or do you hire copywriters? Okay, so there's quite a few questions.
So wants to be better at freelancing.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, I would say
to get his career out of standstill mode.
Yeah. So I would think that's what you got to do. Like, you're going to have to take at least one night a week that you do either a side project or do something you like doing. Cause it sounds like you're getting bored by the government SharePoint work, which that can happen, you know, cause it's a slower means of operation. Right. Yeah, man. I mean, I think you got to do a side project. That's my thing.
Yeah.
You could do
go for it.
You could do freelancing. I mean, but it sounds like you've lost your confidence, which maybe.
Well, if you want to switch careers at some point, you're going to have to get paid for that side project or freelance. So maybe that's what Colin is thinking.
Yeah.
And remember, though, that is it a lack of, he says literally a lack of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to build that confidence. Maybe the side project will get you there. But at some point, if you build a website and you've done it, you've completed it, and there it is on the screen, you've done more than the people that would hire you to do it have. So you get to get some free confidence from the fact that you've gone through this process once. And that's what you are selling as a freelancer is, you know, in a way. Is that like you've done it and they haven't, and you're going to be a decent human being with good communication skills, you know, smile on your face, and you're going to walk them through this process of building them a website. And that's worth some money. That's what they're going to pay you to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see that your confidence is a little lost if you haven't worked on this stuff in a long, long time, but get yourself up to that level of having built a website. If it's one that you're not going to make any money on the very first time you do it, well, I guess that'll have to be the case. But now that you've built one, then get yourself a client and trust yourself.
Yeah. I mean, team up with somebody. I mean, you know, I know tons of people who are looking for developers, you know. I mean, maybe you just say, hey, I want to come in on a project. You know, I can give you 10, 15 hours a week, you know. You know, if that, does that work for you? You know, I mean, and then, you know, talking about like, he says design development aren't a problem. What do you do about content and stuff like that? I mean, I would say, you know, if you're a designer, a developer, like you are, that's not your job, man. I would, if you hire a copywriter, I'd bill for that. But then I don't know if you, I would personally not start development until the client has content. That's my MO there, which that may be hot drama-y, but
it is a little bit. I'm trying to decide what to say about that, but I think I'm going to stay out of it. And I think that we should earmark this one for a content strategist and see how they would answer this question. I mean, I'm sure they have, you know,
yeah.
Start with the content, says the content strategist, you know, of course, but,
I mean, I think
they might tell you that designing, starting a project without having any kind of content or maybe just saying like, you know, hashtag not my job, get the content first, isn't the right way to deal with it either. That you should be, there should be some kind of way to hold their hand through helping them create that.
Yeah, I would say that's true. I mean, for me, in just my experience, it's been like, you know, if you can do things like headers and footers and kind of like start etching out a site, you know, without content, but you get into a pickle, like where either two things will happen, like the client will either come back with like way too much content or way too little content, or they stall out. Because they're not invested, you know, like they're just like, they disappear for like 4 months and they're like, oh yeah, yeah, I was going to get you that content. I need to do that, you know? So that's like a problem for you. Cause now you're like 1 month freelance job is turned into like this 8 month freelance job. And so now you're making pennies on the dollar instead of, you know, getting your final check. So I feel like having them do the content gets them invested in the project from the forefront. So, and just set a date I mean, obviously coach them. I think that's your job as a client services person. So that's where I stand. I'm going to stick to my guns. I'll even write a blog post. I don't care. Chris, you disagree with me.
No.
All right.
I agree with you.
Jackpot. All right.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Sorry about my voice. It will be repaired soon.
We'll get you back. You just need some tea, green tea and honey, man.
Yeah. Don't feel bad for me. I feel fine.
Well, cool. Yeah, so we got lots of questions. Man, I feel like we need to do another rapid fire. We got like enough content already. So,
we definitely do.
Keep sending in questions, though, of all the, because there's plenty to learn. So, all right. Well, this has been another rapid fire episode. Thanks everyone for listening. Rate us up in iTunes, 5 stars. It's that easy. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. Buy a t-shirt, shoptalkshow.com/store. And Chris,
shoptalkshow.com. That was weird, but that deserved it. Needed to be weird.
It had to be. That's good.